Radio.
The Contemporary Mind, Proposing the Need for God, by Archbishop Julian Porteous. This talk is from the Fifth Credo Colloquium, entitled The Power of the Message, the Kerygma for the New Evangelization.
My talk on the Contemporary Mind and this whole issue of what is happening in contemporary culture is an important question for us as evangelists. So I think it's very important that we do seek, in one sense — this will be a bit analytical this morning — but I think it's important that we do stand back a bit, because we're immersed in our culture, caught up in so many things that we've grown with, we've experienced and so on. But today I'm hoping we can just stand back a little and look at what has in fact transpired, mainly over the last 50 years, in an effort to understand those changes, understand the way people perceive things, the way people think, their worldview that many today have, and therefore to help us refine our ability to communicate with them and communicate more particularly the gospel to them. So that's really what I'm hoping to do this morning. What I want to do is use the 1960s as the watershed period, because the 1960s saw two things happen. One was the beginning of a whole range of quite profound social changes that flowed across Western civilization. And secondly, of course, for us as Catholics, it was the occasion of the Second Vatican Council. And so we can see that the council actually took place at a time when there was quite profound changes occurring. You know, the whole sexual revolution, that whole unrest that was occurring at university campuses across the world, the anti-war movements, particularly focused on the Vietnam War, the drug culture, the emergence of the drug culture, the rise of feminism. These were just some of the factors which were sweeping across Western culture in particular, the culture that we know here in Australia, United States, in Europe. That this was a turbulent period. We could say that since this period, there's been really three generations. And I want to look at these three generations that have gone through this period, that emerged out of this period of great social change and great change in the church, and have been influenced and affected by various changes as they've unfolded in our society. The three generations I'll speak about are the baby boomers, what we commonly call the baby boomers, those who were born in the period after the Second World War, when there was a great increase in the number of children being born, a kind of reaction to the war. Generation X and Generation Y. Generation X were the children of the baby boomers, if you like, those who grew up in the 70s and 80s. And then Generation Y, those grew up in the 90s into the new millennium. So that's the other three generations I initially want to just discuss with you about. But I think in order to understand these generations, we have to go back, and I'm probably betraying my age and in saying this, but I can remember — maybe others can as well, but others probably won't know about things I'm going to talk about, or maybe heard about them but haven't experienced them. I had some experience of them. But I think to understand the changes that took place from the 1960s, we have to sort of have some picture in our minds of what it was like to be a Catholic prior to that. And to think of family life, for instance, in pre-television days, where family life was quite significantly different, and where a Catholic family, for instance, a grace before — the first thing they sit at a table to have dinner, not watch a television while having dinner, but they'd be sitting at a table, they'd be saying grace before meals. It was just what you did as a Catholic. And maybe a lot of good Catholic families would have the family rosary in the evening after meals. That's what you do. Your family would gather around and say the rosary. Not unusual for the family home to be influenced by various religious items. There might be a statue, but there'd certainly be a picture probably of Our Lady, of the Sacred Heart. There might be a plaque commemorating the family's consecration to the Sacred Heart. There might be a range of them. There might be a little holy water stoop at the beginning of the children, at the doorway of the children's bedrooms and so on. But in other words, it'd be very clear signs this was a Catholic home. People would really be aware of that. And it was very natural. It's just what you did. You just put various religious items on, very clearly seen in the house. A practicing Catholic family would be quite closely allied to the local parish, and their religious participation wouldn't only be limited to attending the Sunday Mass, but there might be various devotions during the week. It might be the novena to a Lady of Perpetual Succor that they might attend. It might be benediction on Sunday night that they'd go along to. The family members might belong to various sodalities, like the Holy Name Society for the men, the Sacred Heart Sodality for the women, Children of Mary for girls. They might be, members of family might be active in groups like St. Vincent de Paul Society or the Catholic Women's League. So, you know, Catholic life meant quite a range of engagements beyond just coming to Mass. And of course, there'd be numbers of people who'd be going to the weekday Mass, which would tend to be at 6:45 in the morning or sometime like that, rather than 9:00 as it often is today. And that the parish life would also offer a whole range of religious, not only religious events, but also a range of various social opportunities, particularly because we weren't watching television, and so it was nice to have social activities. So, of course, in those days, particularly, there'd be various fundraising nights, the housie, the fates, these sorts of activities, but would bring the parish together. They'd be working together to raise funds for the school or to build a new church or whatever. Then they might, the young people might be involved in various social activities by the Catholic Youth Organisation. Dances on Sunday night were quite common, picnics. The parish might have a football team playing in a Catholic sporting competition and so on. And various people might belong to various Catholic organisations like the Catholic Tennis Club or Catholic Bushwalking Club. I was a member of the Catholic Bushwalking Club and so on. So there might be various clubs that were social outlets or recreational outlets that a Catholic would be involved with. Also in the parish itself, there would be the presence of religious in the parish, particularly the sisters who maybe staff the local primary school or the secondary school. The brothers might be in the parish and be there at morning mass each morning, be seen around the parish in a variety of ways. And the sisters and the brothers might be contributing to the parish in a variety of ways. They'd be visibly present at major parish events. Maybe the sisters would be providing extra services out after school, like music lessons, that they'd go along to the convent, the girls be learning the piano and so on. The teachers, the nuns might be helping the kids from the state school prepare for the sacraments. The sisters might be out there visiting the sick or doing door-to-door visitation and so on, working closely in cooperation with the priest or priests of the parish in the general pastoral involvement in the life of the parish. And of course, every Catholic really knew what it meant to be a Catholic. They understood that their place in the church, they understood the nature of the church, they understood also their place in society. People and Catholics were often known as Catholics at work or in their social organisation, sometimes turning up on Ash Wednesday with the ashes on the forehead was a visible sign. But generally speaking, people knew who were the Catholics in the general environment. It was often comment on the fact that you're a Catholic, you know, we know you're a Catholic. And because Catholics had definable practices and traditions. We didn't eat meat on Fridays. And I said, we were marked by the ashes on Ash Wednesday. And we wouldn't go to other churches for weddings or funerals because we weren't really allowed to do that. And while there'd be some residual sectarianism, where sometimes Catholics were prevented having certain rights, opportunities for employment and so forth, This probably ended up strengthening their sense of identity. They felt different from others in the society. So that's a little very quick broad brush strokes of what life was a little bit like from what I can remember in my own experience growing up, say in the 50s. This was what was inherited, if you like, by those who were born, the baby boomers, who were born in the period after, like myself, in the period after the Second World War. But they became caught up, particularly in their teenage years and in their early 20s, with these profound social movements which were sweeping across Western culture, whether it was student activism, experimenting with drugs, being enticed to seek greater sexual freedom, or simply imbibing a sort of great spirit of optimism, hope, sense of peace and love. This generation was caught up in a kind of whirlwind of social change and new attitudes and new approaches. And as I said, there were other changes were also sweeping the world of a Catholic in those days, and they were the changes that emerged from the Second Vatican Council. So some people saw that the church was, this was very opportune, because the church also was changing as the society was changing, and they saw this was the church coming to terms with modernity, if you like, and wanting to be willing to adapt to new and changed circumstances. And so this generation started to see and witness various experimentation in liturgy, as people were trying different things in liturgy. It was also the time when, there's a great deal, I'll talk about this later, a great deal of interest in the questions of the rights of individual conscience. And many people started to question a lot of traditional practices. Why do we adore the Blessed Sacrament, the rosary's old hat? Why do we have statues and pictures, holy pictures, and so on? Let's get with the modern world. Let's be a more able to live in the environments in which we now find ourselves. So there was a sense from the Second Vatican Council, many people took up, was the church was developing a new self-identity, and certainly one of the focuses of the church now was perhaps from a certain fortress mentality, the church was now wanting to really be open and engaged with the world around us. And one of the things too that people started to say, well, if you can change the liturgy, then maybe we should change a few teachings as well. And so there came this idea that nothing really is immutable, and we shouldn't take everything as absolutely divinely inspired. And so people say, let's start adjusting the church to be able to effectively be relevant and engage with the new culture that was at play. And this was the generation that began to say, well, why is it a sin not to go to Mass on Sundays? And I believe, and you know, this sense of rules being implied. Really, what's important about being a Christian are the gospel imperatives of love, peace, freedom, and so on. And so there was this tendency to really want to resist the formal authority of the church. And so many, under the banner of, if you like, the spirit of the Second Vatican Council, believe the church had now irrevocably changed and was embracing the modern world. They believed the church was abandoning its old ways and seeing a lot of things in a new light, and people thought this was very good. Now, as we look back on that period, we'd probably say that, as using the words of Pope Benedict, who had great insight into this, he said there was a hermeneutic, that means an interpretive principle of continuity or discontinuity, or rupture. He would use the word rupture. In other words, people were saying, look, the church is now changing from this to this. But Benedict would say, no, the church is just as a living organism. It changes, it has over time, but there's essential continuity. But many people felt that, no, it's really a change from one church to a new church. And so... the baby boomer generation, those born into this this maelstrom of social change and change within the church, really embraced a lot of this, and many became strong protagonists of seeking to advance the church and Catholic life and so forth in new ways. that they saw that, you know, we're finally breaking free of some of those shackles of Victorian morality, of a certain legalism, a sense of dull obedience to authority, and we're moving now in new spirit of freedom and openness. One could say that this particular period was significant because it marked what could be called the experiential shift. I think this is a useful way of understanding it, that what happened was in people's minds and people's understanding of things, they moved from a sense that the ultimate authority for one's life has shifted from a reliance upon religious and political authority to an orientation towards one's own personal experiences, senses and feelings. So I don't so much look out there to get guidance and understanding for things, I now look to myself as the point of reference for my understanding of things. And so the notion developed that we should really form our own views and our own attitudes in the light of our own experiences. One expression of this that was taken up very, very strikingly and continues to be a very important issue in the church is that the Second Vatican Council, in its document on its declaration on religious liberty, Dignitatis Humanae, spoke about the whole notion of individual conscience in relation to freedom of religion. And the council said, contemporary man is becoming increasingly conscious of the dignity of the human person, and more people are demanding that men should exercise fully their own judgment and a responsible freedom in their actions, and should not be subject to the pressure of coercion, but be inspired by a sense of duty. Now, that was right, the sense that we shouldn't, people shouldn't be coerced and forced. However, it was embraced with the idea that no, what we do now, we follow our own conscience. We hear that mantra being spoken of a great deal. And what happened was that the people then took the attitude is that very much that I'm the one who makes decisions about my moral response to various circumstances. All this came to a head, of course, with the production of the document on the Humanae Vitae 1967, which particularly addressed the issue of the moral appropriateness of contraception. And of course, this whole movement swept forward when people said that they can't accept the teaching, will make decisions according to conscience. So they were children of their age and the thinking of their age. What was also happening through all this, though, was that there was a serious eroding of a sense of Catholic identity. And many people really wanted to be more comfortably fitted within the society of the day and wanted to be accepted. For a long time, we'd been seen as different, strange, and sometimes there was prejudice against us. Now there was the opportunity to be part of the culture, to be accepted as having a legitimate place and role in the general social directions of the day. And so dialogue was favoured in place of confrontation. Ecumenism was to replace proselytism. Respectful tolerance was to be favoured to the delineation of differences. Generally, there was a desire for a synthesis between society and the church. But the risk of this synthesis, of course, was assimilation. The Catholics would become citizens of this world first, and the distinctive nature of being Catholic would largely be lost. And this was what tended to happen to this particular generation. So they were caught up in these streams, and so then they became a generation that very much believed in personal choice, believed in the right to freedom of opinion, and certainly felt they had every right to question, challenge the teaching and practices of the church and to make decisions about what they felt was appropriate for them and what wasn't. It was this generation then that that produced the next generation, Generation X. So I'd like to just talk now what happened with Generation X. So they came, their parents were going through these effects and so on, and they were caught up in it as they were growing up. And we can see that this generation had its own very distinctive spirit. To a large extent, they were reaping the whirlwind which was sweeping the church and society. For them, their experience was nothing is fixed or solid. Experimentation was widespread. As many in the church were mapping a way forward. So they lived in that environment where there was experimentation, change, adaptation, try this, try that, and so on. They were a generation who became disengaged with the church because they felt the church had nothing to offer in terms of clarity and direction, because the church itself lacked clarity and direction. They very much became a lost generation. One of the clearest indicators of this abandonment of their faith was the loss of the practice of regular attendance at Sunday Mass. Much of the horror of a lot of their parents who still went to Mass, even though they're, in one sense, they still had a Catholic heart, but they didn't have a Catholic mind. But they still had a sense of tribal loyalty to the faith. And they were pretty horrified when their children couldn't see the point. And so we know, we're very aware of this, but there's a dramatic drop. And so now, present moment, we would say that among that this particular generation, that you've got single digit levels of participation at Mass. We know this very, very well. Baptized Generation X's would still identify themselves as Catholic, but they'd be more at home with the notion that what was important to them was a certain spiritual sense of life than acceptance of the Catholic faith. The catchphrase which we've often heard, that I'm spiritual rather than religious, was very much the catchphrase of this generation. And such an approach was very attractive to this generation, who said that they're willing to keep a general sense of allegiance with the church, a general sense of being Catholic, but certainly there was no sense of any need to conform to what they might describe as the demands of being Catholic, like attending Sunday Mass. So very much their Catholicism was a Catholicism on their own terms. Another significant shift in perspective for this generation was a focus very much upon moral values rather than upon dogmatic beliefs. So Generation X saw that social justice, for instance, was the way one expressed one's Catholic faith. And many schools took this up and really put the focus of what it meant to be a Catholic, or how they could engage their students at school in Catholic life in terms of presenting social justice teaching, social justice programs as a way that they could offer Catholicism to their students. And this generation embraced this idea of justice. It's still very much evident around us at the present moment. But they saw little value in beliefs. They really just wanted to be involved in social action. And so the various social issues came to the fore, and they embraced them very generously. Poverty in Africa, for instance, and now, of course, the environment is the big issue. And so much effort now has been turned to concern for the well-being of the environment. The pedagogy that they experienced at schools in terms of their religious education tended to be experiential rather than doctrinal. And so students very much encouraged to explore their own world and not so much to be exposed to the great traditions of Catholic thought. So an ignorance of Catholic tradition, Catholic practices, Catholic customs grew in them. And so their sense of being Catholic, their Catholic identity, was being more and more weakened. Basically, this generation, Generation X, had a very low religious socialization. Their parents had lost the incisive sense of being Catholic, and so were not really able to pass on that Catholic culture in a very clear way to their children. This generation now was a generation that had little knowledge of Catholic teachings, traditions, practices, in an era we hear people more speaking about Catholic ethos than anything else. And this is this very vague, nebulous concept of being Catholic. And so in when you're living an ethos, you're really living just in some kind of vague atmosphere, which doesn't necessarily allow itself to be expressed in any clear way. So they really lacked a sense of Catholic identity and really lacked any sense of what really meant to be Catholic. Religious socialization is normally assisted by a person having certain discernible markers that can give clarity to who they are and what they're about. And so, for instance, harkening back to an older age, a Catholic family might say, well, we're a Catholic family, we say the rosary every night after the evening meal. This generation probably couldn't really identify anything that was a clear marker, because all these markers fell away in Catholic life. And indeed, family life in a Catholic family really is much the same as family life, the family next door that has no faith whatsoever. How is one family, a Catholic family, in any way different to their neighbours? There may be a few little things, of course, that Christmas and Easter are still considered important, maybe efforts to go to Mass and so forth, participate in various things connected with Christmas and Easter would still be done. Maybe we feel a sense of the need to be involved in the Seasons of Lent, so we'll do some Lenten practices. But largely, this was all being lost to people. And this Generation X Catholic was more or less content, though, with where they were at and what they were like. There was no sense of guilt about not being involved in the life of the church as they may have felt they should be. So that's Generation X. How did Generation Y fare? So this will be the generation coming out from Generation X. These trends will obviously increase, because at this stage there's no strong movement in the other direction. Lest you think I'm an absolute pessimist, I don't believe it's all going downhill until we crash at the bottom of a pit. I am optimistic, but at this point I've got to be very realistic in what I'm saying. This Generation Y would grow up with ever weakening formative experiences which would nurture their Catholic identity. So the sort of tests that could be carried out in terms of people's understanding of their Catholic identity and what they believe reveal this very clearly. And these indicators, these tests have been done, and the information is available to us. So indicators like belief in God, getting back to very fundamental principles now, belief in life after death, attending Mass, willing to pray. What we see is that these things are slipping further and further out of the life of those who would be a baptized Catholic, and certainly their sense of self-identification as a Catholic had declined very significantly. So baptized Catholics from Generation Y began to identify as much with ideas of the New Age or with secular moral attitudes, tolerance, anti-discrimination, respect for homosexuals and so on, as with any particular Catholic belief. Conviction about belief in God or life after death was really seriously reduced as Generation Y becomes tentative and agnostic on these issues. What is in evidence is not so much the explicit rejection of the Catholic faith, but rather a general vagueness and uncertainty about the Catholic faith. This has led many to begin to look for a search for some sense of meaning or direction or purpose to life. And one way it's described currently is that people have embraced a sort of, I think it's a very useful term, a moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, what that means, and I think it's a very good descriptor of Generation Y. So there is a sense of some vague spiritual orientation to life, but in no way is it transformative. This vague spiritual orientation is really a desire for some sort of comfort in the midst of uncertainty. And this generation has shown really a very low capacity for any moral reasoning, and would generally slide into individual preference as a basis for making moral decisions. So that's where we're at. It's a little work to be done. Let's look, though, at some of the forces that are currently at work in our society. I'd like to talk about what really I think now is a global culture. I found this, and Kathy mentioned I travelled around a bit and different places. And really, what we see is that largely through media in all its various dimensions, that a young person today is living in a world that is very similar across the globe. And so a teenager in Delhi or in Rio de Janeiro or New York is likely to know the same songs and be attracted by the same styles of music. In broad terms, you can sort of see songs that flood the world, go right across the world. And you can see that Rolling Stones can go to Copacabana Beach as well as a Pope and have a large gathering there, and so on. There are bands that travel the world and are known in all the major cultures. People will tend to see the same blockbuster movies. They'll sweep the world and people will go to watch them. Generally, a lot of computer games will be common and used across this global culture for young people. They'll all communicate by Facebook and Twitter. They'll all have a mobile phone, which will become their principal agent for personal communication. We don't talk, we tweet. This culture, it's not static, it's a dynamic reality, but this is the world, this is the environment, this is the culture that is shaping their minds, their understanding of reality. So there's a global culture at work, fed through the media in various ways. And I think it's very important for us to be aware of this, because this is now the contemporary mind. This is what's happening to the mind, and I'm talking particularly about a current generation of younger people. So today's culture is not principally influenced just by a certain national identity or national ethos or something. You know, yes, we have certain things as Australia, different from if I was a Nigerian or I came from Brazil or somewhere. But generally speaking, the culture that informs my mind as a younger person is really this global culture, rather than something which emerges directly from my national identity. And far less does the church or the family have the major dominant influence on the minds of young people. And now this has been created, as I said, by global mass media, films, songs, computer games, advertising, new technology products. And people are more and more living within a virtual world rather than a real world. And while there's no conspiracy here, it's not as though there are these dark people in back rooms planning all sorts of evil things for humanity. But it's just, you see, the media is largely market driven. It's not ideologically driven, even though ideological elements can creep in and people can use the media in various ideological ways, but largely it's market driven. So this works, this makes it turns a buck, and so that's why it's been so effective in what it's been doing. This is largely shaping the way people see themselves and understand life and reality. There are three elements I'd like just to very briefly highlight that I think are key expressions of this global culture. The first one is secularism, which basically means that a person is living for this world alone, and that's very much what the media does. It's focused particularly on immediate sensation, immediate experience, and so secularism is very much fed by this environment, and what people look for are good experiences, entertainment, and of course travel has such a high priority because it's all about having interesting experiences. So that's the first thing, secularism. The second one is individualism. This is a focus upon self, and this is really what the advertising agencies are continually promoting. They're continually talking to you about yourself. They're continually encouraging you to seek things for yourself. They're continuing to encourage you to really put yourself at the center, to make yourself the most important thing, really, for your life. And so today we hear people, this is very typical of our age and our generation, people say, what's in it for me? You know, that's often the deciding factor in terms of what I do. If there's something in it for me, I'm interested. If there's nothing in it for me, I'm not interested. The third element is relativism. Basically, that people don't sense that there is any objective reality or objective truth. And that basically, in line with what I was saying before, people have to basically work out their own truth. And largely, it's a pragmatism. So what people would then embrace is, look, this works for me. And so I will make moral decisions. I'll make decisions about life, about where I live, and all sorts of things based on what seems to work for me. And so people have the attitude, well, this is for me. That might be for you. That's fine. You go and do your thing. But this is what I do. And people will live according to what they think is right. So they don't so much look to an objective source of truth and guidance, but they'll make up their own minds as to what they believe to be true and right for themselves. So it's not that these sort of people so much reject God or religion or the church per se, but they really have come to a point where they can't see the value or worth of God or of faith, of the church, of religion, of moral teaching. God has largely become irrelevant to their lives. And they find that they can sort of live okay in the main, as though God does not exist. So God doesn't have to come into the equation. Or if God does exist, then they have a sense that God probably doesn't have any particular problem with the way they're living, because basically God understands, and they're not bad people. They're not doing terrible things. So surely there's no particular reason why God should not be happy with them in the way they're living their lives. So they feel that they're basically good and reasonable human beings. But John Paul captured this very clearly back in 1988 when he wrote in Christopher Day's Laici he talked about this radical transformation that was taking place in the nature of faith. And he saw this particularly in the First World, where he says that countries and nations of the so-called First World are now in a situation that they live a life such that God does not exist, an indifference to religion. And he saw that as a great challenge, and I think that was really a genesis for his own focus on the new evangelization, because we have to address this question of people coming to a point where they feel that God does not exist. Now, how could we describe a modern person in the light of this? Well, I'm going to propose, and I'm really talking here about people who have some background. There's another whole group of people who've had no faith background or come from another faith background, Buddhism or whatever. I'm just going to talk about people, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I'm just going to talk about people who have had association and background in the Catholic Church. And I think probably one of the useful ways of describing these sort of people is to call them post-Christian agnostics. So they've had some Christian background through family, perhaps through school, and went to a Catholic school, but they really have now abandoned their Catholic faith to all intents and purposes. They're agnostic in the sense that they've not so much rejected Christianity formally and embraced atheism, some have, but rather they've withdrawn from a position of faith, and as I expressed before, are quite uncertain about spiritual things. They may believe that there's the existence of some sort of power out there, but they have no clarity about the nature of anything beyond this life. It's all just too hard and too uncertain. There are some defining characteristics of what we could call the post-Christian agnostic. Firstly, as post-Christians, they have had some exposure to Christianity within their personal backgrounds. They've had some exposure to the culture of Christianity. But they've come to a position that Christianity, more particularly the church, holds nothing of value for them. They are people who would describe themselves, as I said before, look, I'm spiritual but not religious. That's how they'd see themselves. They do not see themselves as holding to any religious system. And they certainly wouldn't adopt an integrated Catholic approach to life. Although they do have some vague spiritual aspirations. As agnostics, they are uncertain about the nature of God. They will often say that they believe that there is some form of higher power. They cannot define the nature of God, and they do not imagine that God is in any way capable of intervening in their lives. Generally, however, they do not investigate this question and leave it really in a too hard basket as something which is really an unknown, and they don't know how they can penetrate that unknown. Because of a sense of a higher being, they're often then open to wanting to have some kind of spiritual presence in their lives. And so they will, generally speaking, be attracted to things that have some kind of spiritual orientation, but come from a whole variety of sources. So they may generally have a broad acceptance, for instance, of reincarnation. They might sort of think that seems a reasonable theory, and so they have this sense of that, and they've got that out of Eastern religions. Or they see a value, that they're attracted by the idea of using mantras or sitting on the floor in lotus positions or taking part in some kind of spiritual experience connected to that. So they might feel that yoga is very good and they're very interested in a lot of the yoga, the notions behind the yoga practices. They might get very interested in angels. Or they might just be really interested to get direction and guidance for their life by going along to some sort of fortune teller or the reading of tarot cards. So they feel quite free in moving in these different environments because they are kind of spiritual but not religious. So they are kind of open to some sort of spiritual orientation to their being. So in other words, while rejecting religion, they've basically embraced all sorts of ideas and practices that have some kind of spiritual basis to them. One aspect of this mindset of the post-Christian agnostic, I think it's very important for our work in the new evangelization. Such people are very skeptical about religious authority. I've already explained the origins of that. And very skeptical about organized religion and particularly about the Catholic Church, because that's the worst of expressions of organized religion to their mind. And so they often carry very strong prejudices against the church, which they see as out of touch, judgmental, excessively demanding. And so while they may be attracted to some broad general aspects of Christianity, they don't envisage themselves ever attending any formal church activity. So if you go up to your classic post-Christian agnostic and say, would you like to come to Mass with me? You're wasting your breath. Post-Christian agnostics also, of course, have a particular scientific mindset. They regard matters of spiritual belief as needing to be proved. So they really struggle with the notion of faith that Father Gerard spoke so beautifully about this morning. They really do have a great deal of struggle in this whole idea of a leap of faith or elements to knowledge which are different from scientific sources of knowledge. So they approach Christianity and transcendental realities as a whole from an intellectual perspective. So they apply their mind to matters of faith. So everything has to be processed through the mind. And what does not satisfy the mind cannot be accepted. So a key strategy for the new evangelization is that while, of course, the Catholic faith does contain an intellectual element, the key is the heart. And we saw that with what Monica was doing today. And I think that's been very important for us. We're not going to win the battle in the area of the mind. But the Christian agnostic is searching, is seeking meaning, because it eludes them. So One of the questions we need to ask ourselves is how are we going to go about this evangelism? How are we going to bring the kerygma to bear in on a post-Christian agnostic? One of the things that I just proposed today, and it's really something I've just been thinking about and can't really give a great deal of evidence, except for a few conversations I've had with post-Christian agnostics, is that any effort to just barge in, if you like, with the Christian message from the outset will just lead to a person bunkering down in their quasi-scientific approach to things. So as soon as you come out with some Christian truth, you're just going to, the doors are just going to come up, the blinkers will go on. So one avenue of approach, certainly I've found myself, it's probably good to begin the conversation in talking about the nature of the human person, because this is the arena in which they operate. They're very interested in their own personal experience and in the experiences of others, and there's a possibility for sharing here, and there can be a possibility for discussion. Certainly it's been my experience in a few instances when I've done this. And so you're able to talk about ultimately love, trust, hope, and so on, and that can open up the possibility of moving on, because this isn't so much intellectual and it's not so much something which can be scientifically proven or analysed. And so we're sharing from the point of view of the common human experience, because this is very much where people are at today. And that can open up the broader questions about the nature of human life and nature of relationships in human life, and can work, certainly in cases where I've done it, lead then to a question of relationship with God, looking for a relationship beyond ourselves. I'll just say a few words. I think we all know about religious affiliation in Australia. I find it very interesting that the last census, the 2011 census, revealed to us some very sobering information. And that is that, firstly, the good news, if you like, is that the Catholic Church is the largest single religious group in Australia. One in four Australians are Catholic. So I often think when I walk down the road and there are four people there, one of them is going to be a Catholic. When I'm sitting next to somebody on a plane, as I was coming back from, where was I recently? Hobart, this week. The two people next to me were Catholics, so we had a great conversation. So that's useful to know. But the next biggest group in Australia, coming in at 22%, so if we're 25 point something, coming in at 22% are those who claim to have no religion. So we can see that this is a very sizable chunk of our population here in Australia. And of course what this does is it gives those who are promoting the secularist cause great source of encouragement. And so they feel more and more confident that Australia is becoming a secular nation. And they think it's only a matter of time before the majority of people are religious. And they often get surprised when somehow religion seems to keep hanging on more than they anticipate that it would. But we hear claims, then, don't we, that the society is moving beyond religion, that in particularly Christianity in a place like Australia is being marked out as something which is in terminal decline. And certainly we're aware that this is a reality now in our culture, and a new reality in the sense you've got all these people, almost a quarter of the population, who would very clearly, very, very, very strikingly say, look, I live as though God does not exist. I have no point, no value to anything in relation to God. And so this encourages those who are promoting changes in society based on secularism to crank up their efforts. So the whole gay marriage, if you like, same-sex marriage issue, the bringing in things about abortion, euthanasia, all the usual things that we're known, they feel great confidence because they feel that they're on, as they often say, be on the right side of history. This is where things are going. So, and of course, anybody who does want to hold to more traditional beliefs about things, about marriage, about homosexuality, about life, all these sorts of issues, is really seen as being out of touch. More important, being intolerant, because they're not accepting the views of what is becoming the emerging majority, and very much we're lumbered with the word of being a fundamentalist or a homophobe or whatever. And I think we're going to find that that our freedom to express our faith and even to evangelize might well be under threat in the time ahead. One of the things I like to say about what is happening in society is that, and a basic principle I believe very clearly, something that Pope John Paul spoke very clearly about when he said that an eclipse of God, in other words, as God is eclipsed, so like the sun is eclipsed, God is, the sun's still there, but just can't see it anymore because it's been covered over. So when the eclipse of God takes place, no longer see that, there'll be an eclipse of man. That actually what will happen is that this will also lead to a breakdown in people's personal lives and indeed in the quality of life within society. So this is an issue that we need to be very aware of and look at these broader cultural implications to what's happening with our society. And so in Evangelium Vitae, the great document of the Gospel of Life of Pope John Paul, he speaks of the culture of life, the struggle between the culture of life and the culture of death. That's our struggle. That's the struggle in our society. It really is a culture of death, which is going to be destructive. Not only abortion, euthanasia, but in all sorts of other elements, we're going to see a culture of death that could take over, and we are ones who are going to fight for the culture of life. So just concluding, I believe that even there's all these changes have taken place, these cultural changes that have occurred, all the ways that the contemporary mind has been shaped and formed by all sorts of forces and factors. We always still remain human beings. We're not just somehow automatons shaped and created by these forces, somehow like robots now being reprogrammed. We're human beings. And human beings do have certain things built into them from the Creator, which will always orient them towards the Creator. There'll always be in people a questing and a searching for the things of God, for the things of the spiritual, for a purpose and principle and value to life that can't just be found in what can be seen and felt and touched. And so people at various moments in their life, and I think Father Jared spoke about it very beautifully today, people can be going along in this, under this culture, these cultural influences, be shaped by them, be influenced by them, but in the end they're not going to be productive. In the end they're not going to be fruitful. In the end they are death, not life. And so people will at one stage, sooner or later, come to a point of finding these things are not satisfying, are not meeting their needs. And so there will be a questing and a searching for something. We see already people trying other religions, searching out for different things that might give a spiritual value or meaning to their lives. You know, the great phrase, an oft-quoted text of St. Augustine, we know very well, God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. It's true, absolutely true. He knew it from his own search, his own journey. And it's true for every human being. They'll search in the wrong places at times, they'll think they've found the answer, they'll live it, maybe all their life. But in the end, it won't satisfy, and they'll feel they've missed something. There is a rest in God that is only the final place of rest for every human being and for the questing of the human spirit. Because we are created in the image and likeness of God. We have an eternal soul which longs and searches for God. And we cannot find ourselves, can understand ourselves. We cannot find completion as human beings apart from God. And anybody who cuts themselves off from God for whatever reason or hasn't found the reality of God in their own lives has a vacuum within them which they'll seek to fill in one way or another. They often talk about this God-sized hole. You know, there's a dirty big hole in us that can only be filled ultimately by God. Every single human being created by God, and that's every human being, needs God and cannot be complete without God. And no human society will ever be healthy without its citizens having God in their lives. And no human life will ever find its ultimate meaning without God. No human being can ever find their final destiny without God. So the Catholic faith has the answer to the human quest. We have a treasure in our faith we often take for granted. We have the words of eternal life because we believe. This is what every person needs. It's what our society needs. And this is the responsibility of us, every one of us as Catholics, to seek to offer to the society, the world in which we live. Thank you.
That was Archbishop Julian Porteous with The Contemporary Mind. The Fifth Credo Colloquium was organised by Sydney's Catholic Renewal and Evangelisation Diocesan Office and held at the Catholic Centre in Lidcombe.
Radio.org.au